On this week's 51%, a researcher makes the case for the importance of interracial friendship among young people.
I think that children who share cross-race friendships have an opportunity to learn about each other beyond ubiquitous racial stereotypes.
Hear how a few women are helping refugees with a language barrier to healthcare, and a figure skater endeavors to bring more Black women to the ice. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Dr. Chinzia Pika-Smith believes the topic of cross-race friendships in the U.S. to be an important one, and in this divisive political climate, more so. Pika-Smith is a researcher and professor at Assumption College in Worcester, Massachusetts, in the Department of Human Services and Rehabilitation Studies. She is the coordinator of the concentration program, working with children and adolescents in community settings.
First of all, I suppose I'll begin by saying that friendships are absolutely critical to how children mature their understanding of the world around them, indeed how all humans mature their understanding of themselves and themselves in relation to others, and that it's fundamental to the way that we express and understand intimacy, affection, and companionship. And in children, friendships are the way that children develop socially, emotionally, cognitively. And so in an increasingly multicultural, multiracial, and pluralistic society as we live in, cross-race friendships then are important, are fundamental to children's development. And they are demonstrated to have a myriad benefit to children, to adolescents, and to us as adults as well. They're associated with prejudice reduction, with decreased outgroup anxiety. Children who have these friendships have increased empathy towards one another, increased cultural competence, social skills, increased multi-perspectivity so that they're able to really take on different ways of thinking about each other. And this, of course, is connected to critical thinking. So, you know, I think these are benefits that we can't ignore. This is, as an educator, something that is incredibly important to me as I think about children and their development. But most importantly, as a social justice educator, I would say that the reason I think about these friendships as being so important is that I think that children who share cross-race friendships have an opportunity to learn about each other beyond ubiquitous racial stereotypes, and that they themselves say that this kind of learning is important to them, right? They recognize it. They talk about it. You know, when I interview young people, elementary school children, middle school children, they talk about these friendships as friendships in which they have learned to think differently, to recognize stereotypes, to stand up for each other, to interrupt prejudice. And in the case of a child who was particularly meaningful in my own development, and the child who perhaps ignited my interest in this topic, you know, she described herself as a peacemaker, as someone who, through her bonds with children across these racial divides, was able to really practice this community building, this peacemaking activity. So I think that these are really crucial and important relationships in many, many, many ways.
At the risk of oversimplification, then, does this mean the children involved will perceive interracial friendships as the norm?
children themselves actually don't oversimplify the topic at all. The children that I interviewed talk about these friendships being challenging. They talk about them being hard. They talk about them being difficult to begin and to maintain. So it's an excellent question. Once they're in the relationships, they find them deep and meaningful, but they do talk about them being challenging. And even when they're in them, they're often fraught with misunderstanding. And they're quite rare. In fact, research reveals that they're not as prevalent as same-race friendships and that they decrease as young children grow older. There are so many barriers to cross-race friendships. Obviously, we live in racially segregated communities. Parents are the ones who contextualize young children's lives. We live in segregated neighborhoods. Children go to mostly segregated schools. Nationwide, our schools are more segregated today than they were in the 1960s. And even when children go to relatively racially diverse schools, and that again is not the norm, unfortunately, schools are not places of racial equity. So even in those racially diverse schools, children are generally tracked and segregated within school settings. So children's lives are quite racially homogeneous, and children don't have an opportunity to have many cross-race friendships. So these friendships aren't actually the norm, and they're few and far between. And so we don't see as many as we might imagine. They're not really as prevalent.
The challenges, as you just mentioned, some come from within the friendships, but I would think other messages about cross-race friendships are coming from the community. Other friends, for example, are sending messages, subtly or not so subtly, that this is unacceptable.
Well, sometimes that is the case. Parents, for example, parents' racial attitudes have a lot to do with whether or not children engage in cross-race friendships, and not necessarily even explicit messages. But we know, for example, that adults have racially homogeneous social networks, so that the majority of American adults have exclusively same-race friendships. Upwards of 75% of white Americans have exclusively same-race friendships. And so children are not seeing their parents and grandparents and caregivers in cross-race friendship situations. And so, you know, they're observing friendships as predominantly same-race relationships. And so even though they may not be getting explicit messages about, you know, you're not allowed to have friends across ethnic or racial or cultural lines, you know, I don't think that is the case for many young people. At the same time, they're not seeing their parents having dinner parties or inviting friends who are identifying across racial lines. And so that is certainly impactful. And, you know, there are studies, recent studies that reveal that when parents of children don't have friends that cross racial lines, that is closely related to the friendship groups that their children will also mirror. So we see that in the friendship literature coming up.
What is there to be said about gender in cross-race friendships?
There is some literature that points to gender differences, both in children and in adults. So in my own research in 2011, I published a study in which girls had more positive perceptions of same-race friendships than boys. Now, these weren't real-life friendships. These were their perceptions of same-race friendships. But that mirrored previous literature on same-race friendships, real-life same-race friendships, in which there were gender differences, where girls seemed to have fewer cross-race friendships than boys. And authors of that previous research hypothesized that girls enjoy more intimate relationships than boys, that interracial differences by gender have been explained by the fact that boys focus on team sports and game activities that are governed, by rules and regulations and require less intimacy, and so are less discriminating in their friendships across racial lines, and that friendships that require more intimacy and confidence in contact are the friendships that they observed in girls. And interestingly, in adult cross-race friendship, in that literature, a researcher by the name of Deborah Plummer and her colleagues have found that women have fewer cross-race friendships than men. But when they do, those friendships are described and rated as deeper and more intimate than men's cross-race friendships. So it seems that friendships are understood, how girls and women might make meaning of friendships is different across gender, and that may impact cross-race friendship and how girls and women rate those friendships. So although the rates of these friendships may differ, it may have more to do with the level of connection and how the type of communication and the confidence and contact that is required for the kind of relationships that are being experienced.
So, as an educator researcher, how do you look to set more examples of such friendships?
Friendships will not happen between children who do not enjoy equal status. And so if we focus on the larger picture, on the picture of racial equity, friendships will follow. What we shouldn't do is to think about cross-race friendships as a means towards prejudice reduction or social justice. But the other way around. We should focus on social justice, and then the friendships will follow.
That was Dr. Chinzia Pika Smith on the importance of interracial friendships among children. She has delivered a TEDx talk on the topic and continues her research. Refugees and other immigrants face lots of obstacles when it comes to getting health care, and the language barrier is one of the biggest. Side Effects Public Media's Sebastian Martinez Valdivia visits a clinic in rural Missouri that's trying to help Congolese refugees.
At a pediatric clinic in Kirksville, a young boy is waiting in an exam room to be vaccinated. A nurse explains the shots to his mother, and Lisette Chibanvunya translates. Chibanvunya is one of two Congolese interpreters the Northeast Health Council has hired to help the clinic care for refugees and immigrants from Central Africa. She first came to town to study at Truman State University in 2013.
When I came, I faced discrimination. Because they didn't have a lot of black people. But now they start accepting people because they finally understand that people kind of decided to make it home.
Since then, the town estimates at least 800 Congolese people have arrived in the area, many coming to work at pork processing plants. Among them is Chibanvunya's colleague Babette Nzuzi, who says she was a doctor in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Like many skilled immigrants and refugees, she couldn't continue her work in the U.S. without going through an extensive relicensing process. Instead, she ended up working at the nearby Smithfield plant.
So I was just patient, and I used to work at Smithfield Farmland. And then a friend told me about application for a translate, So I try and they are me. It's interpreter.
While the DRC's official language is French, there are more than 200 languages in the country.
Some people cannot speak French. They speak Lingala. But for us, it's easy because we can speak French, Lingala, Swahili, Kikongo.
Before Nzuzi and Chibanvunya started working for the Health Council, doctors and nurses had to rely on automated translation services like Google Translate. But that left gaps.
They speak a different dialect of French, and so you can't even tell the translator phone French sometimes because they don't even understand that.
Amanda Wilford is a nurse practitioner who runs the Health Council's clinic in Milan, 30 miles to the west. She says having someone like Nzuzi who can translate over the phone is a big help.
And so we just call her on a cell phone, and she just pops off and on the cell phone whenever we need to call her. She's a very busy lady.
Nzuzi and Chibanvunya both came to the U.S. through the State Department's visa lottery. But thousands more Congolese have come as refugees. Last year, the U.S. took in more than 9,000 refugees from the DRC, nearly half of the total admitted. That country's continuing political instability and ethnic conflicts have displaced millions of people. When refugees arrive in the U.S., resettlement agencies help with the language barrier.
They provide the fundamentals of helping them find housing, helping children find schools, helping the adults find employment.
Dr. Anielai Anamalai is a psychiatrist and internist at the Adult Refugee Clinic at the Yale School of Medicine. She says these support structures can be critical for refugees' health.
We talk a lot in medicine about the social determinants of health, and especially more so for refugees because they're coming with nothing. So I think that basic foundation needs to be there.
But in a small town like Kirksville, where the nearest resettlement agency is an hour and a half away, there's more pressure on groups like the Northeast Health Council. And the interpreters help negotiate cultural differences as well. Chibanvunya recalls helping a patient who needed a C-section, but didn't want one because in the DRC, they can be a lot more dangerous.
That language problem couldn't make the person understand that this is the only way we can do. So I came in and then I helped the lady understanding, and finally they end up having the baby through C-section.
Nzuzi wants to do even more for the area's Congolese community. She's working on her English skills so she can begin the process of obtaining a medical license in the U.S. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
Black figure skaters are far and few between. Deneen Richburg is one of just a few in Minnesota, and she's created a project that puts stories and movements of the African diaspora on the ice, an historically Eurocentric space. KFAI's Anna Stitt takes us to the rink.
Okay, we're ready.
From an ice rink in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Anna Stitt. I'm at a rehearsal for Brown Body. It's an arts company that centers histories and movements of the African diaspora through figure skating and dance.
I started skating at the age of 5. I just remember being really young, and I loved the sensation of flying across the ice. Like, I would skate as fast as I could and then try and whip myself into some kind of spin, and it was very freeing for me.
This is Deneen Richburg. She's the figure skater and dancer who founded Brown Body. She grew up in Maplewood, a suburb of the Twin Cities.
So you're growing up in Minnesota, very predominantly white state,
yeah.
Super white,
mm-hmm.
Ice skating,
yeah.
Is super white.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, yep. Generally.
Yeah.
At what point did you notice, race?
When I was really, really young, I would compete, and I'd always end up like last or second to last. And then, you know, people would come up to my mom, other skaters' parents, or even sometimes other coaches, and they'd be like, wow, I'm surprised. Why was she last? You know, she did all the elements, or she skated well. You know, it seemed like she should have been up higher. And that didn't really faze me until I got a little older, and I'm like, oh yeah, you're right. I did skate okay. I did pretty well, and I'm still like last or second to last. And that's when I started connecting, like, oh, I look different from all the other girls. Not only am I darker complected, my hair was different, my facial features were different. I've always had hips. I was never the petite little, girl out there.
Deneen kept competing until an injury stopped her in her early 20s. Then she left the skating world and got more into theater and dance. But she loved that feeling of being on the ice. So she decided to come back on her own terms with Brown Body.
We don't see black bodies on the ice for the most part. We really need to experience what it is to be able to be in this space that is dominated by white standards and white ideals and be in our skin, but also be a true human being.
The number of serious black ice skaters in the U.S. is small. And in Minnesota, Deneen is one of just a few. So when she's ready to put together a piece, she brings in skating artists from across the country. Right now, Deneen is developing a piece on black social dance during slavery. She expects to put it on the ice in 2020. This spring, she went ahead and produced an excerpt, The Ring Shout. It's a spiritual tradition that blends a circular shuffle step dance with songs and rhythmic hand clapping. Deneen calls the practice a site of collision.
Africans were forced to practice a very European sense of Christianity on one hand. And then on the other hand, you have different African tribes and cultures, but there's still, even though people are being thrown together and people don't speak the same language, but there's still this connective tissue of values, of perspectives, of movement.
Deneen says the shuffle has to take a different form on ice, but she works with the other skating artists to embody the energy and intent of the movement.
Swing me, swing me, swing me, swing me, my lord.
This process of bringing people together, of connecting with the ancestral plane, of this being a practice and a moment of release and of coming back and restoring and coming back to wholeness.
For KFAI, I'm Anna Stitt.
Swing me, swing me, swing me, swing me, swing me, swing me.
We'll stay in Minnesota to hear about a new exhibit at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, or MIA. It honors Indigenous women artists from many nations in North America. Reporter Lori Stern met up with MIA's Dakota Hoska for a tour.
Haumatakiapi, Dakota Imakiapie, Lakota Wianhemacha, Ga Wazi Ahaha Ed Omawapi, Chakpa Utunwe Edwati. Hello, my relatives. My name's Dakota. I'm a Lakota woman enrolled in the Pine Ridge Reservation, and I live in the Twin Cities.
Dakota Hoska is a painter who spent much of her adult life making and studying art. She's been working for MIA on the new exhibit for 4 years.
One of my favorite parts is this Rose Simpson tricked out El Camino. And this is a car that this artist built from the ground up.
I had noticed the black lowrider pickup in the middle of the room, but for some reason, I didn't realize we were already in the exhibit. Dakota Hoska pointed out the detail. The black glossy design on the black matte finish, the black suede covers on the black leather seats, the rebuilt engine, the pulsing sound system, the special brakes a powerful car needs.
She still drives this car. She actually offered to drive it up for the exhibition. We're like, no, 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 we'll ship it. But when it gets back home, she'll drive it.
Rose Simpson, the artist, lives in Española, New Mexico, which is the self-proclaimed lowrider capital of the world. Simpson has been working on cars since she was 12. She named this 1985 El Camino Maria. Its design honors traditional black-on-black Puebla pottery. Its power defies machismo culture.
So she's doing a lot about questioning gender, questioning power, questioning a tradition and stereotypes, and it's all kind of encapsulated in this one work.
Just beyond the El Camino is a gallery with a video screen. The artist Mona Smith recorded the activist Juanita Espinoza greeting visitors to the exhibit. This is Juanita.
My knowledge of what I understand to be native art is that it's the act of doing. Because there is no word for art in our culture specifically, many of us forget that in this culture that we've come to adapt to, it puts labels and titles on who we are and how we should be. And then it creates a measure. In our way of life, the act of doing and creating and sharing encourages a communal family approach to how we live our lives and how we encourage each other. So there is no scale, but only a recognition of the act of being a maker.
After the greeting from Juanita Espinosa, visitors enter galleries that display regalia, paintings, videos, sculptures, pottery, and other installations, each one as carefully curated as it was made. A panel next to each piece of art tells visitors about the artist and the context, in English and, where possible, in the language of the maker. Dakota Haska says, at last count, 68 languages were represented.
We were gung-ho about translating all of the languages, but some communities came back and said, you know, we don't share our translations with the outside world. There was a lot of, like, give and take and deep listening. It was hard for a Western institution who is running on deadlines and timelines and budgets and those things. Like, deep listening kind of pushes the boundaries on all of those things.
Maybe good art always pushes boundaries, but this exhibit does it deliberately. Every single piece challenges conventional thinking. The exhibit was produced by a 21-member, all-woman, mostly Native board. It will be at MIA through August 18th, but will live on in a catalog that's available at the bookstore or online.
A lot of them were saying, I was looking for this stuff in the scholarship and I couldn't find that. I want to leave a legacy for our children. I want our young women artists to be able to find this when they are looking. And so the exhibition is great and I love it, but the catalog was in some ways more important for us because that was really a directive from our board that we created something that went on.
This story was from Minnesota Native News, produced by Ampers, and was made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1562.